go ahead, Doug.
Okay, so this talk will be a review of the work that we've been doing on scattering amplitudes over the past few years. I think it will not contain any new things, so people who have already heard me talk about this well, might be bored if they understood everything about the previous talks. And I'll try to explain it so that someone who has never seen it before will understand it. These were our collaborators that worked on various papers. The results are scattered in various papers. It got simpler as time went on. And there will, Amit and Pedro are going to write a nice review that will explain it in the simplest possible way. That's going to appear soon. Now, why would we be interested in calculating scattering amplitudes in n equal to 4 at strong coupling? Now, the one motivation is that it can be done, because at strong coupling, we have weakly coupled strings in ADS5 cross S5. When the radius in alpha prime units is very large, and so in this regime, we should be able to do it. So all that needs to be done is to translate the problem of the scattering amplitude problem in string theory in ADS5 cross S5, and then we expect that we will be able to actually do the calculation. So that's one motivation, but that's not a strong enough motivation. The second one is that it exposes the structure of integrability in a simpler way. So the classical sigma model in ADS5 is integrable, and it's much easier to see that that model is integrable than sometimes to see that the weak coupling perturbation theory and so on is integrable. So that is another motivation. And related to that motivation is that it can become easier to see some of the consequences of that integrability, and we'll see one example of that, which is a simple derivation of the relationship between amplitudes and Wilson loops, and that's a consequence of the properties of integrability, and it's very easy to see at strong coupling, and also the symmetries of the Yang-Yang and this dual conformal symmetry is also very simple to see at strong coupling. And furthermore, it's a good testing ground to try to understand how to apply the techniques of integrability to get the answer. So getting the answer is not totally trivial, and you have to make use of integrability, of the symmetries of integrability to get the answer. So the answer is a complicated function of the momenta. It's not, and you can only, you can get some properties of this answer by using the integrability. And so it might be a good good lesson on how to use integrability for this non-trivial, non-linear problem. If you're interested in eventually solving the problem for all values of the coupling, it gives you at least some idea of what should the strong coupling limit be. You also understand the weak coupling limit, and maybe one could make inspired guesses for the extrapolation or understand better the integrability structure for all values of the coupling. And this is, in fact, what the model that has been followed in the past to understand the problem of operator dimensions. People first understood, let's say, analyze the problem at weak coupling, also at strong coupling, and trying to understand the relationship between the two. Finally, the whole structure was understood enough so as to be able to actually compute those anomalous dimensions for all values of the coupling. So I'm going to start describing what problem you need to solve to calculate the scattering amplitude at strong coupling. So the first thing you need to do is to find the gluons. So we have string theory in ADS5 cross S5, and we don't seem to have the gluons that form the external states. So that's the first problem. And it is not surprising we don't see the gluons, because the gluons in a conformal field theory are not good asymptotic states, and so that's they are not gauge invariant also, and so that's why we are not seeing it. Now, in order to define amplitudes at even weak coupling, so let's say at one loop and so on, you need to put an infrared regulator. And that's what we can do here too. And the infrared regulator in this case is simply to take one of the scalar fields of the n equal to 4 super Young Men's theory, which is an n by n matrix, and we divide it into big blocks of n by n. So this is an n by n block, and this is a smaller n, little n by little n block. And we put here some expectation value of, let's say, could be the identity in this little n by little n block, and zero everywhere else. And if we do that, then what we are doing is, in the language of brains, we have a large number n of brains. We are always going to work in the very large n limit, so in the Toft limit, where n is equal to infinity and lambda is fixed and much bigger than 1. Okay, so we're always going to work in this limit. And then we're separating n brains out. So in this limit, the gluons on these brains at very low energies are very weak, because in this limit the Young-Mills coupling is going to zero, and so we can define good asymptotic states to be gluons or open strings living on these brains, and then they collide. Now, at strong coupling, these are just some brains that live inside ADS5 space. So this is the infrared of the ADS5 space. We don't really see these brains, but we will see these N brains in some background ADS space. So we have some ADS space. This is the UV of the, well, the region of the boundary of the ADS space that corresponds to the UV of the field theory. And we can choose some coordinate C here. And we can write the metric, the ADS metric, in terms of this coordinate C and some coordinate. These are coordinates in 3+1 dimensions, 3+1 dimensions where the field theory lives. And then this is the radial direction of ADS. And here we have some coordinates that see infrared, which we are going to take to infinity in order to remove the infrared cutoff. Okay? Is this setup, is it clear to everyone? And now we collide these particles, and something that is important is that when we're trying to calculate this amplitude, we're trying to calculate an object for fixed field theory momenta. So we fix the momenta of all incoming particles. So we're computing some amplitude with fixed n, fixed external momentum is a color ordered amplitude from 1 and so on to n, and we fix all those momenta. And we keep them fixed as we try to remove the infrared cutoff. Now, as we try to remove the infrared cutoff, these brains move deeper and deeper inside the ADS space, so that this warp factor is becoming, so C is becoming larger and larger, and this warp factor is becoming smaller and smaller. And that means that the fixed momentum, fixed K momentum measured with respect to these X coordinates, is becoming a bigger and bigger proper momentum. So this is always happens when you're approaching a region where the warp factor is going to zero. So in formulas, we can say that this momentum is sort of dx, right? And the proper momentum is sort of dds, the derivative with a proper metric. And this is the proper momentum should go to infinity. So we divide here, we get C dx, right? And so that's the same formula I was talking about. We are keeping, and this is C times K, right? As C infrared goes to infinity, the proper momentum goes to infinity. OK, so this is a collision that is happening at very high energies, here. So it will excite the string oscillators. So if we have two open strings, two massless degrees of freedom, they collide and they will excite the open string oscillators. And naively, you would think it's very complicated, but it's actually simple, because we are computing an exclusive amplitude where we have simple outside states, and we are not colliding these two particles and letting anything happen. We're colliding these two particles and asking that something very specific happens. And that something very specific thing, that very specific thing will happen with low probability. And so there will be, and so the whole amplitude is a little bit like a tunneling process where we are asking a question about a very improbable thing. And for that reason, it's going to be given by a kind of tunneling solution that will tunnel between the initial and final configurations. And tunneling solutions are given by classical solutions. So we can find those classical solutions, a certain classical tunneling solution. This property is also a property of strings in flat space. So if you do the same problem in flat space, you also find that the scattering is described by classical solutions. And Gross and Mende had done that in the past with classical string solutions in flat space. So here is exactly the same problem, but now in curved space. So we really need to solve the classical equations that come from this metric. So we have a sigma model or some maps between the two-dimensional worldsheet and this target space. So we are going to have, for example, axes which depend on tau and sigma. And it will turn out actually that the worldsheet will have a Euclidean signature. So the worldsheet will be a space-like surface inside of Lorentzian anti-de Sitter space. And that is because it's again a tunneling solution. You're used to the fact that tunneling solutions are often solutions of the Euclidean equations of motion. I haven't told you exactly what the boundary conditions are, but I will tell you in a second. But first, we'd like to write the equations of motion for x, which would have this form. So alpha ran over sigma and tau. And for example, the equations of motion for x have this form. Okay. And then there is a corresponding equation for c that I'm not writing. Now, we have to solve these equations with certain boundary conditions. Now, to formulate the boundary conditions, it's a little simpler to do a change of variables. And so here is the divergence of some vector should be equal to zero. And so if we call this epsilon alpha beta d beta of y, that will be automatically zero. So this equation will be automatically zero. So this is saying, for example, that d0 of x is d1, and d1 of x over c squared is minus d0 of y. So one makes this simple transformation. And then this equation is identically obeyed. But the fact that dy, that y is given by these derivatives of x, also implies a new equation for y, which has the form the alpha of y now times c squared is equal to zero. Now if we define c equal to 1 over r, then this equation has exactly the same form as the original equation. Okay, in terms of the new coordinates. And it turns out that the other equation, the one I didn't write, the one for c, also once you do these coordinates has exactly the same form. So the equations derived from that metric are completely equivalent to the equations derived from the metric, this other metric. Okay. So we went from some problem of solving classical equations on the original metric, on the original sigma model, to the problem of solving classical equations for strings moving on this space. So at this point, it looks like we haven't gained anything. And indeed, I mean, in general, you don't gain anything by doing this. Now, what you gain is that the boundary conditions now on this space will be very simple. So the boundary conditions here were that the momentum that this each open string will carry some momentum coming in, and the momentum is really the d0 of x over c squared, so that's the momentum conjugate to translations. So, but that's the same as d1 of y, And so that means that when you go, when you are near the string, if you integrate over the whole wall shed, you should get the momentum, which should be, so the integral d sigma of d0 of x over c squared should be the momentum. And this should be also the integral of d1 of y, or d sigma of y. And this is just delta y, okay? So the change in y across the open string should be equal to the momentum. So the, here in these variables, we see that the problem we have is that when we have a kind of polygon in Lorentzian signature, where we have the momenta of all the external particles, and the surface should be a surface that ends on this polygon. So it's again the picture of a soap bubble, which is ending on a set of wires, right? And the soap bubble is pushed by the gravitational field and then sucks down. And this gravitational field is just the gravitational field that you have in anti-Sitter space, the one that is due to the work factor that we have here. Now, in this case, we were putting this. The open strings were at a particular position, which was this C infrared position. In the new variables, it's a position close to R equal to 0. And so from the point of view of this ADS space, the we now, what was before the UV is now what we would call the, so this is now R equal to 0, or C equal to infinity, and this is vice versa. And now we have these wires all sitting here, and the gravitational field pushes the soap bubble into the interior. Okay, so that's the problem one needs to solve. Now, so one point was one nice feature of these coordinates was that you got this nice simple interpretation of the problem. You have a completely geometric problem of finding minimal area surfaces ending on specified contours. And we need to find the value of the area as a function of the shape of the contour. So we'll have that the amplitude to leading order in square root of lambda is just given by minus square root of lambda. So in other words, minus the size of the ADS space divided by times the string tension. And this was equal to the square root of lambda, and this times the area. So this problem is totally geometric. So this is an area that depends on the momenta, k1 to kn, right, on the shape of this contour at the boundary. And it's this part of the problem is completely geometric. And we just simply multiply by by the square root of lambda, and that gives us the leading order answer. Okay. Now this is then corrected at sub-leading orders in the expansion of 1 over square root of lambda, the alpha prime expansion. There will be here some factor which is independent of lambda, and then some further corrections that go like 1 over square root of lambda. So that's the structure of the answer, and each of these will depend on the coupling. To solve, to find this factor, we need to quantize small fluctuations around the string, and so on. We can find this factor, and then we go to the next order, we find this other factor, and so on. And these have not been explicitly found yet. Okay. Now, now the problem in these new coordinates has some symmetries that were not obvious symmetries, were certainly not obvious symmetries of the problem in these coordinates. So even though these two are two ADS spaces, they are making explicit or making global different symmetries of the problem. Okay. And in particular, the symmetry that is not obvious here, that was not obvious here and is obvious here, is the symmetry of special conformal transformations. In these coordinates correspond to symmetries that were related to integrability on these coordinates. So this simple transformation is related to integrability, and in fact it's equivalent to integrability. So if you say that you should have the conformal symmetry here and also the conformal symmetry in these coordinates. That statement is equivalent to saying that the system is integrable, because it's exposing extra symmetries that the theory has. So let me say that a little more in detail. Let me see how am I doing time. Yeah, maybe I'll explain this in a little more detail. Would people like to see this in a little more detail? Yeah. Okay. So I'll just sketch how you see the statement that I've just made. So and for that it's useful to think about the expression for the generators of the symmetries here. So if you have a symmetry, so you have some current, J mu, J alpha, that is expressed in terms of the fields, that generates the symmetry, and then the corresponding charge is some integral d sigma of the zero component of the current, right? So let's think about the currents that generate special conformal transformations. Now we have the special conformal transformation K. I'm going to suppress indices and I'm not going to write the full exact expression. That has a form roughly like d0 y squared over r squared. Okay? D sigma. Now, this is the expression. It's a local thing on the wall sheet that we integrate the current along a spatial contour and gives us the conserved charge. So that's the expression in terms of these coordinates, and that corresponds to the explicit isometries of the theory. Okay, so it's what we would call the trivial symmetry of this problem. But now we can use these relationships. So for example, we first use this guy, and we write this first factor as d1 of x. So this is like d1 of x. And now we integrate the d1 by parts, and we get something like d sigma x d1 of y squared times y. Now we use the first equation, and we rewrite then this as d sigma x d0 x over c squared. And so this has the expression of one of the, and I'm, there is still a y here. This has the expression of one of the currents, the dilatation current of the original variables. But we still have this y factor, and to write this, we are going to use one of those equations again, and we write this as the integral d sigma prime of d1 of d sigma of y, and now we use the equation. And so in the end, we get the integral d sigma of x d0 x over c squared times the integral of sigma d sigma prime of d0 x over c squared sigma prime. Okay, and this has the expression of the integral of d sigma of some dilatation current component 0 times sigma d sigma prime the momentum current of sigma prime 0. Okay. And this is the expression for the conserved charges, the non-trivial conserved charges that follows, that are related to integrability. So the statement of integrability is the statement that there exist extra conserved charges in the original sigma model, which are not given by local expressions, but rather by this bi-local expression, for example. So this is the expression of the non-local charges related to integrability. Okay.
Juan.
Yes.
If we have the theory on T1 instead of S5, it's not integrable. But somehow this doesn't seem to matter. I mean,
That's right. Yeah. So the argument I just described only uses the classical and shows the classical integrability of the ADS5 sigma model. Now, here I never even talked about the S5, and the S5 is totally irrelevant for the classical limit, so for the leading order, and the answer would still be the same if you did the T11 model, so it's given by the same expression, but these factors would now be different. Okay. So Then you can ask, well, is this change of variables that we described here, can it also be done in the full quantum theory, so that you can compute also these corrections using this other picture, right? And for that, what you need to do is you need to extend the symmetries to you need to also do something with the fermions. So if you only did this with the bosons, you find that the new sigma model actually looks different than the original one. But if you also do a transformation which is very similar, but for the fermions, and that transformation can be called a fermionic t-duality. So this can be viewed as the transformation loss of t-duality for bosonic variables. And if you do this similar thing with the fermions, then you find that you get a completely equivalent sigma model. And so by combining this bosonic and fermionic t-dualities, you get that the full original amplitude can also be computed equivalently here using this. Now that step of the fermionic t-duality would not work for t11, because it would be equivalent. Well, yeah, this fermionic t-duality involves the fact that you have the S5 and so on, and all the supersymmetries that we have in n equal to 4 super m mills. In fact, those fermionic t-duality, even in other cases where we know the model is integrable, it's not known how to do it using the fermionic t-dualities. So for example, for the ADS4 times CP3 sigma model, we don't know how to do the argument using the fermionic t-dualities, even though we know it's integrable. So maybe there is some way of doing it, but. So the existence of this bosonic and fermionic t-dualities together that give us the same sigma model is a statement that is equivalent to the integrability of the theory. So, maybe one should say one more thing about the, well, in the S5, because of the symmetries of the theory, we expect to have no boundary. So the problem on S5 will have to integrate over the coordinates of S5. So we'll get a factor proportional to the volume of the S5 and so on, and we'll get factors like this. Now let me say a few more words. Well, now I'm going to start describing how one can find this area. So the problem of, this is a classical problem of finding the area using, finding the area as a function of the momentum. Are there any other questions about the general setup before I get into it? No? Okay. So in order to do that, it's, I'm just really going to outline it. I'm going to make some of the things I'm going to say are not exactly precise, but they just will give you the outline of what should be done. So I'm going to oversimplify, but the details will all be explained very nicely in this article of Pedro Anamen. In order to do this, it's we're going to use the integrability of the theory. And for that, it's convenient to think in terms of a certain flat connection. So we talked about the symmetries of the theory, so the various symmetries that we have. And these are essentially, so if we think of G, so in many of these cases, like in ADS5, the sigma model is a coset, so it's G divided by H. Now imagine the target space was a group manifold. Imagine you had ADS3 and it was a group manifold. So then these currents would simply be given by this expression. For a coset, you can do exactly the same thing. That's the first simplification I'm going to take. So we have these currents, and this will generate the symmetries of your theory. And these currents obey two equations. One is the conservation equation, and the other is if you view the current as a one form, it obeys the condition D. And this condition is saying that if you view the current as a one form, it's pure gauge. So G is the gauge transformation. Okay. So you have a flat you have a flat U, let's say SU2 in the case that, or SL2 in the case that we were doing ADS3. So imagine we do ADS3 strings in ADS3 rather than ADS5. But all that I'm saying can also be extended to the case of ADS5. And so we have this condition which says that we have a U1 flat connection, and the gauge transformation that makes it trivial is simply the embedding of a string in the group manifold. But in addition, we have also this condition, and the two together can be packaged. So these two equations, this can be written in the language of differential forms as this. And they can be packaged in another one form, which is a function of a certain spectral parameter, which I'm calling x. Well, I guess you should not confuse this x with this x. Okay. And these two equations are equivalent to the statement that dA plus A, which A is equal to 0 now, but now for all values of x. Okay. So now we have this flat connection that depends on x. X is called the spectral parameter, and it's 0 for all values of x, and that's equivalent to this sort of Bianchi identity and this equation of motion for the sigma model. Okay. Very good. Now notice a couple of facts. One fact that one can notice is that if you could imagine trivializing this connection by writing it as A is equal to g minus 1 dg, but now a g that also depends on x. Okay. Now it turns out that if you do that, then this g also is a solution of the sigma model. Now that's one observation. The second observation is that because this connection is flat, you can construct conserved charges. So imagine you had the problem on an infinite line, then we can integrate the integral of this A on this infinite line, and imagine that on this infinite line there is here the sigma mold is doing something, there are some waves or things going on in here, and then we integrate this connection, so A sigma, the sigma component along sigma. So this is a path integral, this is a 2x2 matrix, in general it's a bigger matrix, but you do this path integral, and since it's a flat connection, that implies that this is independent of the contour. So if we do this at one time or at a later time, we'll get the same answer. Okay. So this is giving us an infinite number of conserved quantities because we can expand this in powers of x, of 1 over x. Let's say we take x going to infinity. So if x goes to infinity, then this whole thing goes to 0, and we just get 1. Now the next term would be given by this x over x squared. That would be some integrals of star j along the sigma. So those are the integrals we discussed, what I was calling the simple charges or the obvious isometries of the sigma model, integrals of just j0. And then we have things like x squared, and then we have those iterated integrals. So that simply comes from expanding this numerator. And then we have some j0 of sigma, j0 of sigma prime, and some other terms. Okay, and this way we can expand and get all the non-local conserved charges. So that's exactly the same charges we're talking about. And these charges are also called the generators of the Yang-Yang. So these are the level, I think they're called level 1, and this level 2, etc., and so on. And this holonomy matrix, so this is sometimes also called omega, a holonomy matrix, that was useful in the case of operators to characterize the state that is propagating on the cylinder. So in that case, one has strings whose topology is a cylinder, and then one can integrate this omega around the cylinder. I mean, one can do this integral around the cylinder, and we get a certain matrix. And then one can take, for example, the trace of the matrix or the matrix eigenvalues, and that will give us the gauge invariant, the invariant information about the state that is propagating along the cylinder. It's a useful way to characterize the state and to find then the other conserved charges. Now, in our case, the problem is slightly different. We have the surface that is ending on the contour, and when you look at that wall sheet, so we can draw a picture roughly like this. The wall sheet is it's a plane, and it's an infinite plane. And as you go to infinity along various directions, you are approaching the boundary of ADS space. So the form of the solution we are interested in is a solution where the that group element G that we were discussing here is finite and will have some value here in the interior, but as you approach the boundary, that different elements of this G go to infinity, and that's just a signal that you're going to the boundary of ADS space. And you only get to the boundary after you get all the way to infinity, but you are approaching infinity in various regions. Now, we know that we need to end on a polygon, right, at the boundary. So when we go to the boundary, we'll go along some specific directions, and so we can end on the boundary either at some point here in the middle or at these vertices. Okay. Now, it turns out that in various regions of the wall sheet, so various angular sectors, when you go to infinity, you will come into one of these points. Okay. And so there are a bunch of angular sectors where you come to the various points. And as you change between one angular sector and the next, you will describe this straight segment between the two sides. Okay, so that's the shape of the solutions. And as you go into, so in these regions where you're approaching a given angular sector, this group element has a simple form, which various elements will behave like e to the c is the wall sheet coordinate, c to some power, let's say n over 2. Some will diverge, some will go to 0. So in here I've drawn the one that diverges. This grows in some angular sector. Okay. Now, okay, so now to characterize this, it's useful. Oh, I forgot to mention one important thing about this flat connection, which is the fact that if you consider its value at x equal to 1, at x equal to 0, sorry, then this term drops out, and we just have this j, right? So, and then if we were to calculate this holonomy matrix for x equal to 0, what we would get is just essentially the group manifold, or more precisely, the g minus 1 at the one endpoint. Right. Let's say we integrate from A to B, so we get something like g minus 1 at A and g and B, or maybe the minus 1 of this. But so we get this product of group elements. Okay, so now here we could consider, for example, the holonomy matrix going between various angular sectors. And as we go in one direction, it will diverge in some way. Some components will diverge and some will decrease, and similarly here. Now, in order to focus, now we are interested in let's say, for example, computing the distance between two points, right? And if we want to compute the distance between two points, that's somehow related to. I mean, it would be contained if we consider the holonomy that would give us the group element at one of the points and the group element at some other points. But this will contain some terms that blow up and some terms that decay and so on. So in order to isolate the piece that really would give us the distance, it's convenient to isolate the piece here in G that blows up. Okay? And to isolate the piece that blows up, it's convenient to take the matrix element of omega with the solution that decays in the region, let's say, I, and some other solution that decays in region J. Now, what are these things? So Si and Sj are solutions of Da, are solutions of D plus A, some, let's say psi. These were 2x2 matrices. This is just a column vector 2x2 component. So this is solution of the, this is a linear equation that we construct out of this this one form. And there are, this solution, some will grow and some will decay. And if we pick, for each angular sector, we pick the unique solution that decays. And then we can construct this quantity. So again, if x is equal to 0, this quantity will give us the distance between the two points, so roughly like xi minus xj, right? So distance between two points, and so on. Okay. Now. Okay, so far we haven't done anything. We just simply connected this context of, we simply stated that there is this conserved family of flat connections, and that evaluating at zero, we can calculate the distance. Of course, we could also evaluate this at some other value of x, and well, it will give us something. Now, why do we care about this? What we're really interested is in calculating the area as a function of distance. It's why we're going through this detour. Well, this is some detour that you normally need to go to when you think about integrability. You need to calculate something you thought you were not so interested in, but by calculating it, you then can reconstruct the quantity you're really, really interested in. Now, of course, this is not a completely random quantity. I mean, this is, if you think about this as a function of x, these are the conserved charges or particular matrix elements of omega, and so they will give us certain conserved charges for the state that is propagating through the string. So here, there's some state flowing through here from this side of the string to that side, and this is somehow characterizing that state. So that's at least tells you that this is not some random definition, it's something that is characterizing certain conserved charges of the solution. Okay, now, the process of getting the area will consist of two steps. One will be to find some equations that will determine those various these various quantities as a function of the spectral parameter. And then after that is done, there will be an expression for the area. Okay? So I will describe the two steps essentially of this process. Basically, I will describe first the first step. So the objective now is to get some equations for these quantities as a function of the spectral parameter, okay? But of course without knowing the solution. So the whole key here is to get information without explicitly knowing the solution. If you know an explicit solution, then you could calculate this, but it's actually pretty, it's not so easy to calculate. Even if you knew the solution, it's difficult to calculate it. But we are not going to find this explicit solution. All we're going to find is the values of this infinite families of conserved charges. So we'll find this as a function of x. Okay, so this is done by considering certain relations. So now we are going to describe the equations for those distances as a function of x. This can be called the t functions. So this is some tij as a function of x. Okay. Let me call this dij. So we're going to reserve the name t for some specific ones. Okay. Now it turns out that, of course, we have many distances that we can construct. But there will be some relationship between these distances, because we only have n points, so we can't have n squared distances. I mean, we have n squared distances, but they are not functionally unrelated. There are some functional relationships between all these distances. Now, we're in the special case of ADS3, and we can think of these as points in sort of x plus coordinates, x plus and x minus coordinates that define the various points of the polygon. So when we think about distances, just when I wrote those x's, imagine these x's as, let's say, two x pluses, for example, the plus some x plus coordinates. Well, this is just a small detail. If from now on, I'll suppress the plus and minus index. Okay. Okay. Imagine we have two points, well, some set of points, 3 and 4, And then we can consider, let's say, the distance between 1 and 3. Let me see, I get it the same as. Just not to make mistakes, let me do it exactly the way it's written here. So we have these distances, and this is just the product of 1, 4, and 2, 3. Okay? And it's computed by taking the holonomy along these two contours. Now, this product can be rewritten as x2, 4, x1, 3, plus x1, 2, x3, 4. Now, this is a simple identity that you can just simply check that this is true. It's an algebraic identity between the axes. And you can also understand it by thinking about this holonomy. So here, when these lines are crossing, here you have the product of a spinor here and a spinor over there, and a spinor here and a spinor over there. So it's the product of two contractions of these four spinors. And this can be viewed as a kind of Fierd's arrangement identity, where you contract the spinors now in this fashion, right? That's one of the terms, that's the second term, and plus another term where you contract them in some opposite way, okay? Okay, so now this rearrangement, well, this I'm describing, there is a notational problem because I'm calling this x also. Sorry, I apologize about that. There are two x's in the game. I hope you're keeping track of the two.
Is this the same two that Nima used yesterday?
No. Nima used the x, yeah. I was careful about that one, but not about this one. Well, we can call this y's, no problem. Yeah, so all these are y's, okay? These are the coordinates in the dual space, right? And we can think of them as the functions of the spectral parameter, because as I mentioned, even as a function of a spectral parameter, we get a family of polygons. And so we can consider them as a function of a spectral parameter. And so these relationships will be true for all the values of the spectral parameter. Okay, so this is a simple relationship between the various functions that appear. So simple relation, and then B, there is something interesting that happens when you do analytic continuations in the spectral parameter X. So analytic. Now, instead of X, it's convenient to define some other variable theta. I'm going to spare you from the exact definition. Well, you can. Well, maybe I should. Well, let me spare you. So there is some transformation to something we'll call theta. And it is such that, let me first, so if you take theta to theta plus pi over 2i, okay, under this analytic continuation in the spectral parameter, it turns out that the problem comes back to itself. So the spectral connection essentially comes back to itself. Okay. However, the small solutions that we were discussing here that had a behavior s equal to e to the minus dc to the n, and then they are multiplied by the spectral parameter theta, they don't come back to themselves. And the reason is that if you find a solution that is small in some sector, and you start doing an analytic continuation in theta, you're changing the phase of this factor. So this solution will be small in some sector that changes as theta changes. And as you change by I pi over 2, the sector will have changed, but will have rotated a little bit. And due to that rotation, what you get is not exactly the same thing that you started from, but you get one that is rotated. Okay? So if we started from this and we do this rotation, you will get the next one. Okay? So you go from one to the next one. Okay? So now we have two relationships. We have this algebraic relation and also this functional relation between these various conserved charges or cross ratios. Okay, so we can now, and these two can be combined into a set of functional equations for these quantities. Now, I said I would reserve a name T for one particular one of these. So we pick a special point, and then we consider all the distances from the various this point to the various other points, right? This is 0, 1, 2, etc. so these TIs, and these TIs obey the theta plus I pi. Well, let me call theta plus. This means theta evaluated at we are summing here pi over 2. Now, these distances were not completely conformal invariant, so we can set the d1 0 to 1. Well, this distance, I mean, we can choose the conformal, the scale factor, or the scaling of the solution, so that we set all these functions to just 1. Otherwise, we could also work in terms of cross ratios. I mean, these distances are not conformal invariant. We could also work in terms of cross ratios. And in fact, so these are the equations in some gauge, but we could also write them in terms of gauge invariant quantities, which in some gauge, in this gauge, they are ti minus 1. And in terms of these equations, so the yi's are cross ratios. They are particular cross ratios, which they basically, in terms of the various sides of the polygon, they look like, let's say you take these distances. So you take these two in the numerator and these other two in the denominator. Okay, that's the cross ratio. You take consecutive ones here and so on, and this will be these functions. And this obey an equation which is more or less this one. And now we have simply these equations as a function of cross ratios. So when x was equal to 0, or for a special value of theta that also corresponds to theta equal to 0, we have simple, I mean, these relationships are just simply the ordinary relationships we have between cross ratios that that follow from relationships of this sort. For theta different from 0, they are more non-trivial relationships. And they are such that together with a suitable analyticity condition, essentially saying that when theta goes to infinity, all these things should go to 0, all this y should go to 0, then we can find a solution to these guys. So in other words, we have these functional equations. We also have the conditions that when theta is equal to 0, we have the physical cross ratios, which I'm going to denote with a slightly different letter y of theta, right? Sorry, these are independent of theta. These are the physical cross ratios of the problem we really want to solve. And we can then translate this and these two to a set of functional equations, okay? And these are have the form log of y. Maybe I should. Am I over time? No. Yeah. Oh well, that's very dangerous. That's true. Okay. Then we have some kernels theta theta prime, and then log of 1 plus y, I plus or minus 1, okay? Okay, so these are these functional equations, and this is some particular kernel which involves cinches and cauches. We could in principle solve this by iteration. So if these y's are all very small, these external y's are all very small, this quantity will be fairly negative. That means that the y's will be very small when you put them here, right? And so you can first make a first approximation where you neglect this, and then substitute and do this by iteration. Okay. Now, so this is the final form for these equations, and here we obtain them as from solving this classical system, but exactly the same equations have appeared in many other contexts. One other context is in the thermodynamic Bethe ansatz of quantum integrable systems, quantum integrable models in 1 plus 1 dimensions. Now, here, well, it so happens that you get the same equations. We don't know whether there is any meaning to these quantum integrable models. So Dori and Tateo had discussed, in general, the fact that certain quantum integrable models give you equations that look like TVA equations. And this is an extension of some extension of what they are saying. They have also appeared in the analysis of Hitchin systems, and these have also appeared in the analysis of BPS states in four-dimensional n equal to two theories, in the work of Gaiotto, Moore, and Nitschke, and so on. Anyway, so this is just a side comment, and then one can find an expression for the area. Now, finding the expression for the area requires us to go back and write the expression for the area in terms of the currents, and one notices that that expression for the area can be obtained from the behavior of these wave functions at special limits. So let's say when theta goes to infinity or theta goes to zero, by expanding around those points, you can write down the expression for the area. And the expression for the area turns out to be equal to essentially the so-called Yang-Yang function. Of this Y system. Now, more explicitly, the area, actually this first term, that it involves some logs of the physical cross ratios with some matrix here that can be explicitly computed. So this is a very simple term, almost trivial term. And then there is this YY function involves a light die logarithm of YI of theta. So integral, let's say du, let me say d theta with some measure, and then another term that involves a double integral involving the kernel and the logs of the y's. Okay, so that's the final form of the area. So the idea is that you solve these equations, you find the solutions as a function of theta and as a function of the physical cross ratios, and then you plug it in this formula, you get your area. Okay. This area, this formula has some nice features, so you can easily take these collinear limits in this formula. Collinear limits correspond to some of the y's going to zero, and what happens is they simply drop out from some of these equations, and you get one thing I forgot to mention is this is the area for the remainder function. So the area is actually infinite. We subtract all the divergences, and then there is a remainder function, and that remainder function is given by this formula. This term that you get here has something to do with exactly how you subtract the divergences. So in some specific scheme of subtracting divergences, you get a specific first term here. This has a form similar to the BDS answer, or to the logarithms that appear at one loop. That's no coincidence. That's because we can choose different things to subtract, and you get this term. And here, and then you get this other more universal in this piece that really has very particular forms related. They really know about the strong coupling answer. You can easily take these collinear limits. So since this is a remainder function in the collinear limit, it should factorize into the sum of two, at least to leading order. And this indeed happens because you set some of these y's to zero, you get two factors. And then you can go and find the subleading corrections, Amit already gave you a talk and explained that these subleading corrections can be, some aspects of this can be computed to all orders in the coupling, and you did find that a strong coupling, that statement is true, and you can really find the particles propagating on the GKP string, a strong coupling, and so on. Very good. Couple of questions. One is whether, of course, it would be interesting to know whether something like this also happens for general values of the coupling. I guess the simplest problem would be to try to understand the loop corrections. So the first alpha prime correction and see how they correct this formula. Because in the case of operator dimensions, computing that one loop correction was actually pretty important for understanding the all loop answer.
So you said sublinear correction, sublinear
in alpha prime, yeah, or in 1 over square root of lambda.
The things that were computed were already sublinear.
Which things?
Things that you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, these are subleading in different, That was a different limit. So what Amit was talking about was taking one of the y's and sending it to zero. So that's a certain collinear limit. And this limit you can take at any value of the coupling, weak coupling, strong coupling, whatever. And then when you take this limit, you find that the remainder function, so this area is equal to the remainder function. So the remainder function is the remainder function for one polygon plus another polygon, right? Plus some corrections that have the form of the exchange of certain particles or certain states, right? And in this context, you are exchanging some particle that moves on the string wall sheet. So, and it's subleading in the sense that this is given by some sort of powers of this y, okay? Very good. But now another thing we could imagine doing is we have this amplitude which is equal to e to the minus square root of lambda area, and we can try to compute the prefactor. So that would be the next correction. Okay. And again, one would need to understand now to compute that prefactor. In principle, so one generic remark is that normally we think about these prefactors as determinants of operators. But using integrabilities, it's difficult to compute these off-shell determinants. So because integrability is about the, lets us do things on-shell. So solutions that are things that are solutions of equations of motion. So for example, this flat connection we were talking about would not be flat if we are not dealing with a solution of the equations. So then one has to manage to compute this determinant using solutions. So, and that for the case of operators was done. So Pedro and collaborators have done also this for operators. You can compute these corrections using using purely solutions. And I mean, the usual formula, for example, you are all familiar with is, let's say for a harmonic oscillator, for a field and so on, you can have an expression for the ground state. The one loop correction to the ground state energy is given by the sum of one half, the sum of the frequencies, and these frequencies are determined by solving the equations of motion. The same can be expressed in terms of computing an off-shell determinant, but here we would like to find, we like to find generic small fluctuations to the solutions we are discussing, right? But we'll also have to include small fluctuations both in the S5 directions and in the fermionic directions. So one needs to learn how to do this that was so far done purely in ADS5 to also the case of fermions and the phi sphere. And even though the general discussion I made here made it look like it would be trivial to extend it, there were some details that I omitted that required that involved being in ADS5 in an important way. And probably this calculation should be done in such a way that it's completely independent of those details and then expanded to the full ADS5 cross S5 sigma model. And then one would have a way to eventually compute this one loop corrections. Now, let me mention one other thing about fermions. So understanding the fermions on the wall sheet is also important for computing next to MHB amplitudes. And so one expects that if we have the surface, the supersymmetric Wilson loops that Simon discussed and also Skinner and Mason discussed involve inserting certain fermions along the edges. And so we'll insert on this wall sheet, we'll insert fermions, which will be small fermionic perturbations that will propagate on this wall sheet, and they could interact with each other, for example, and so on. And for example, these three-level diagrams are likely to be the leading contribution to the next two MHB answer. So the next two MH, next to MHP is likely to be a tree level. This is just a conjecture. This is, we don't know whether it's completely true, but we expect that this is the next to MHP amplitude will be the MHP amplitude times a factor which will be given by these tree-level diagrams, tree-level scattering of fermions on the string Walshed. And so, since it's tree-level, one expects that by using classical solutions of the full super sigma model, one would be able to compute it. That's another reason for trying to extend this to the fermions. So one was to compute the one-loop determinant, the second is to compute this an MHP correction. Okay, I'll end here. Thanks.